From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank. Hi there. Welcome to the Bryant Park Project. It's an hour of news and information from your dear friends here at NPR. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. And getting to NPR headquarters in New York today, Luke, was something. Oh, we lost our music. A minor feat. New York City subway system flooded out.
Yeah, because of a thunder and lightning and rainstorm last night. It was so bad that I wanted to go get in bed with my mom and dad.
Aww.
Except they live in Seattle. And it was like 3 in the morning, so I skipped it.
You know, the Fox newsroom flooded. Take to that what you think. I'm not suggesting anything. But anyway, hey, a year from today, on 8-8-08, the opening ceremonies of the Olympics in Beijing, China in the spotlight for all the action, the athletic action, as well as the pollutant and abusive action there, a status report on the road to Beijing coming up on the BPP.
And we're going to talk about global warming deniers and the definition of objectivity. We're going to talk to somebody who wrote the cover story for Newsweek magazine this week. It was called Global Warming is a Hoax, asterisk.
And soon to a stall near you, a toilet paper dispenser that decides how much TP you get per visit to the loo.
Also, a Michael Vick chew toy for dogs, and our friend Matt Martinez with the news. Right now, though, it's time for today's stop story.
Officials say it can now take a week to reach 6 trapped miners in Utah. There was a major setback when some sort of seismic activity collapsed the tunnel that was being dug to reach these trapped men. Here's Robert Murray, chairman of Murray Energy Corp, owner of the Crandall Canyon Mine.
Unfortunately, all the work that we have done since yesterday morning was wiped out. We are back to square one. And it's the estimate of my management and me personally that there is absolutely no way we can reach the vicinity of the trapped miners for at least 1 week at the earliest.
There's also something else that's surfacing, a disagreement over whether the mine collapse was caused by an earthquake, as originally thought, and what the owners of the mine are saying happened, or if the mine collapse was actually what seismologists picked up as a sign of the earthquake. Here's what the owner of the mine, Robert Murray, said.
This was an earthquake. It was 2 earthquakes, and the seismic activity continues.
So what do the experts say? Walter Arabaz is the director of seismography stations at the University of Utah, and this is what he told NPR.
We see no evidence of 2 separate events. At this point, the evidence in hand, more consistent with the idea that the mine collapse was the source of the earthquake waves that were recorded.
Now, the U.S. Geological Survey agrees with the scientists, as the University of Utah does, adding that activity recorded was much, much more in line with a collapse rather than an earthquake. However, the mine company's Murray insists science, it's science, as opposed to Mother Nature, or Mother Nature as opposed to science, I should say.
Yeah, and there was a story in the LA Times today that was pretty interesting about the technique they were using at this mine. It was a very, very kind of risky one where they actually collapse each section of the mine after they get the coal out of it. It's called room and pillar mining, and when they take the last pillar out, it's called the suicide pillar. So that tells you that's pretty dangerous stuff. I guess hopefully some good news. As of hitting the air today, rescuers say that despite this big setback, they're actually making some headway, and they might be as close to 1,000 feet from the miners.
All right, we'll keep you up to date on that story, as well as the rest of the day's news from NPR's Matt Martinez.
Thanks, Allison. Thanks, Luke. Good morning, everyone. Here are the latest headlines from NPR News. Barry Bonds claimed the crown of home run king last night in front of a hometown crowd. The San Francisco Giants slugger broke Hank Aaron's record of 755 home runs. It's a record that stood for 33 years. Bonds broke it with a shot to the deepest part of the ballpark with one out in the 5th inning. The Giants were hosting Washington. Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig was not at the game but called in congratulations and a videotaped congratulations by Hank Aaron himself played after the historic hit. Bonds says his home run record is not tainted. Many baseball fans don't think he's spoken truthfully about alleged steroid use. The Olympics debut 1 year from today, but there are problems on the horizon. The host city of Beijing is dealing with pollution problems that, if they are not resolved, may delay some of the games. Games chief Jacques Roche said events might have to be rescheduled if air quality is not up to scratch. Pollution is one of the many issues facing China. Human rights, press freedom, food safety, and Tibet are some of the others. More on the challenges that must be overcome by China later on in the hour. Democratic candidates met for a debate at Chicago's Soldier Field last night. The forum was sponsored by the AFL-CIO. New York's Hillary Clinton and Illinois Senator Barack Obama used the debate to fend off primary rivals, hoping to move up in the polls. Senator Clinton seemed to come out on top. Democratic analyst Donna Brazile told the Associated Press that Clinton did a great impression of Muhammad Ali during the debate, dodging and weaving as her rivals threw punches. The U.S. military says airstrikes killed 32 militants suspected of transporting roadside bombs from Iran, but local authorities say civilians were killed too. The strikes were carried out by helicopters and fixed-winged aircraft in Sadr City, a Shiite slum in northeastern Baghdad. Pardon me. NASA fueled the space shuttle Endeavour and, barring any bad weather, is scheduled for liftoff Wednesday evening. The shuttle will carry teacher-turned-astronaut Barbara Morgan. More than two decades ago, Morgan was the backup for teacher Krista McAuliffe, who died in the Challenger explosion. Those are some of the latest news headlines from NPR News. I'm Matt Martinez. My throat is clear. The news is always online at npr.org. Back to you, Luke and Allison.
Get a glass of water,
no,
buddy.
No kidding. I'm a broadcast professional. I should clear my throat before going.
Not anymore. Yeah. Not anymore. Thank you, Maddie. This is the Bryant Park Project, by the way. Now, as you probably remember, all last week we were hearing all about Rupert Murdoch and how he closed the deal to buy the Wall Street Journal. And that whole time, I mean, Rupert Murdoch is a very accomplished businessman. I kept thinking to myself, Rupe, have you heard that newspapers are losing tons and tons of money left and right? I mean, even the successful ones are doing all kinds of stuff to try to shore up their bottom line. The New York Times got smaller this week. The paper physically got smaller. It's a little easier to read on the subway.
But aren't I paying more for it now?
In fact, you are, Allison. a 25 cents more. It's $1.25. Speaking of the Wall Street Journal, they actually were giving out free copies in Manhattan this week of the paper with a big sticker from Chrysler on the cover of the paper. And here's a surprise, Allison. When you looked inside the paper, huge ad for Chrysler.
Really? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I would have never thunk such a thing.
I just blew your mind. So we've been hearing for a long time about newspapers, ones printed on paper, are sort of, you know, facing some financial difficulty. We were wondering what exactly their future is. Joining us now is someone who knows firsthand about the challenges of turning a buck in print news. Michael Kinsley is a columnist for Time Magazine. He's edited Slate Magazine and Harper's. He was recently somewhat recently editorial page editor for the LA Times, and he also founded Cat Fancy Magazine. Did you?
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, that was one of, I think, your less known but more proud accomplishments, right, Michael?
So how are you, Luke?
I'm doing great. Thank you for coming on the show. It's nice to talk to you. You've hopped around to many different publications and kind of watched us, I think, at a few different levels. What do you think? You know, are most newspapers still making money, or are they all kind of a losing proposition right now?
Well, you know, just a few years ago, a newspaper in a medium-sized city in America was considered the nearest thing to printing money that existed. You know, they had a monopoly on the local advertising and news. And, you know, there were but since then, various things have happened. You know, the department stores have all turned into national chains. That used to be a big thing. And then the Internet came along. And Craigslist is stealing their classifieds. And, you know, their readers are leaving. And it's not clear how this is going to play out, but owning a newspaper is no longer considered, you know, obviously a good thing.
What are they trying to do at different papers to actually kind of make money?
Well, you know, they're floundering. Everybody's trying to have a great website. And, you know, pull back for a second. You know, the idea, I mean, one, the problem everybody thinks is that they're giving, that you can get it for free on the Internet. You know, the New York Times, well, to go way back, Slate, the website I founded,
sure,
we tried to charge $19.
Yeah, and you made me mad, I have to tell you, at the time.
Well, a lot of people. We had 15,000 umbrellas, and we still have about I'd say 14,000 of them.
Well, you live in Seattle,
storage.
So you live in Seattle, though, so you could probably use like 13,000 by yourself.
We don't use umbrellas in Seattle. that's for outsiders. Anyway, we still have all these Slate umbrellas somewhere, or they have it. The New York Times tried charging mainly for their opinion columns, and there are rumors all over the web today that they're about to abandon that. However, the giving it away for free is not obviously hopeless, in that what the typical person pays for a newspaper only covers the cost of the paper. If that. So, you know, if you could make a deal with people, we'll give it to you for free. Just don't ask us for the paper. You know, call it up online, and that won't cost us much. That could work if they keep the advertising. The trouble is they're losing the advertising, and most ominously, even within the web, newspaper websites are getting a smaller and smaller percentage of advertising because advertisers feel that other sites are maybe more attuned to youth, which is what everybody wants.
Do you think that it's the physical property of a newspaper that people are sort of less and less into, or is it the idea of getting your news in the way that people get news on newspapers? In other words, so let's say newspapers have, you know, very robust websites in 10 years, and that's what everyone reads. Are they going to look like newspapers look now?
That's the key question, I think. You know, as I've thought about this, it seems impossible to me to believe that 10 years from now they're still going to be chopping down trees and carting logs to factories to make newsprint, which is the paper, not the ink, and then, you know, lugging it to the printing plant for the newspaper and then distributing it all over with other trucks. It's an elephantine process, and it's going to go away, I'm convinced. The question is, when people get their news online, is it going to look basically like a newspaper we see today, or is it going to be different in some fundamental ways? And I don't know, but I'm starting to think that it's going to be different, and mainly in that the idea of the professional objective journalist who is the us to you model.
Yeah.
And is going to, I don't think it'll disappear, but it'll be less common, and the more of the sort of community, us to us model will play out. You know, there are websites sprouting up now covering very local news, yeah, which are very dependent on you know, listeners, viewers, whatever you call these people, to supply the content.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if all of this leads to people being a lot more informed or a lot less informed. Michael Kinsley, columnist for Time Magazine, former head of the LA Times editorial page, thank you very much for being on the Bryant Park Project.
You're welcome, Luke.
So maybe that appealed to you, the idea of not cutting down trees to make newsprint. I mean, saving paper is an environmentally worthy pursuit. But what about that paper? What if that paper is, well, toilet paper? How do you feel about conservation now? Yeah, that's what I thought. So if you won't save TP, someone is going to force you to break your giant wad habit. Considering away-from-home toilet paper is a $1 billion-a-year industry, that's a lot of sheets. Behold the Kimberly Clark Professional Electronic Toilet Paper Dispenser, which rations out toilet paper and could be coming to a public stall near you. Sean Nichols is a lead marketer for Kimberly Clark. He joins us right now. And simply put, Sean, how does this electronic toilet paper dispenser actually work?
The way the dispenser works is very simple. You simply wave your hand underneath the dispenser, and it will dispense a preset amount of tissue. There's three different settings that it can dispense. It's 16, 20, and 24 inches. But the key thing that we want to remind everybody is that we're not limiting the amount of tissue that you can receive. You can go back to the dispenser as often as you like to get more tissue.
It's not like a bartender who cuts somebody off after too many drinks. It's not just going to stop dispensing.
It will not stop dispensing. But the key thing for us in developing this product was not necessarily to limit the amount of tissue, but to just reduce the amount of overall waste.
So how did you come to determine these 16, 20, and 24-inch amount? And can you tell me how many squares that adds up to?
16 inches roughly equals 4 squares. Each square is generally about 4 inches in length. So it's about 4, 5, and 6 squares. And the way we came to those determinations was a lot of internal research. We've got dispensers all throughout our facility that we call smart dispensers. They're able to monitor the amount of consumption that people use per event, as well as the amount of times they go back
event.
To the dispenser.
He said event.
You call them events?
Yeah, that's kind of how we've labeled the term an event. So as everybody goes in and takes care of their event, we were able to come up with some average consumption numbers.
Do your people have to sign, like, waivers that they'll have their events monitored?
No, there are no waivers involved. We do not, you know, invade on anyone's privacy. These things are, you know, you'd never know they were there. They're just, you know, electronic dispensers that are able to, you know, track when a door shuts, as well as measure the amount of tissue that's dispensed each time. So, you know, they're non-invasive, so folks, you know,
you'd
don't
really
even
help.
Know they're
you would
there
help.
Most of the time. So combining that research, we also had to take into account where dispensers are placed on the wall. Obviously, you know, the key benefit of this system is not having to touch the dispenser and worry about germ contamination. Well, these dispensers can be placed anywhere on the wall, and we had to be sure that the paper would not touch the ground when it was dispensed. So combining that research and where the dispensers would be placed is how we came up with the three settings.
I'm impressed with the amount of research. I'm going to impress you now with a little bit of research. I went to Googling and found out the average person uses 57 squares a day. So I don't know if that seems like a huge amount. So why is this thing really necessary? Why do establishments, why would I put one of these things in my business?
Well, there's a few key reasons. The first
for
of
handling
which is
your
hygiene.
Business.
You know, that's the general trend in society right now. Is people do not want to be contaminated by germs. They don't want to touch things that other people have touched. I mean, you know, if you look around, nowadays moms are carrying around hand sanitizer and sanitizing their kids' hands, you know, before they have meals in restaurants, and people are really aware of germ contamination. The other thing is, obviously, as we just talked about, reduced consumption. We want to minimize the total impact that we have on the environment, and by going to this system, you will reduce the amount of waste created, and that's because not only does it ration out product on each dispense, but it also uses our Scott Corliss Jumbo Roll Tissue, which is a proprietary technology where we're able to eliminate the cardboard core on the interior of the roll and actually put paper all the way down to the center of the roll. So
you make this almost sound sexy, Sean, when you start talking about non-cardboard.
It is a very sexy product. It is. And we you know, claim it to be in that sense.
Okay, keep claiming. Hey, before I let you go, what happens if the sucker breaks?
You know, that's one of the things that we had to reassure customers, that you'd always be able to get tissue no matter what happened to the unit. So we put really three fail-safes in there. The first and primary one is there's an emergency feed knob on the front of the dispenser. So if the batteries ever die, the logic ever goes wrong in the dispenser, you can use this knob to manually turn the roll inside the unit, and it will dispense our tissue from the bottom. The second fail-safe is there's a stub roll feature, which works as a manual operation. And basically, once the roll gets down to around 2 or 3 inches in diameter, it can go into the stub roll feature, and it will be a manual feed. And the third piece is that the batteries last over a year. So, you know, there's some reassurance there that you will always be able to get tissue when you need it.
Well, Sean Nichols, you people at Kimberly-Clark have clearly thought this through. Thanks so much for explaining the toilet paper nanny to us.
Thank you for having us.
May your next event be uneventful.
Now, Luke, this leads us to a subject that is dear, but not necessarily near to your heart.
I'd say pretty near to my heart. Yeah, Allison, this seems like a perfect time to launch a new segment that I think we should try, and we're calling it Private Time with Luke. Okay, this is where I basically usher our fine listeners into my special room to chat about stuff that's on my mind. Probably stuff that you might be too classy to talk about.
Do you want me to leave you alone with you?
Could I have a little moment in my special room? All right. Private Time with Luke. By the way, why does my special room have a huge leather armchair and a bookcase? This is a fancy, fancy special room. All right, today the topic is one of the more misunderstood bathroom fixtures of all time, the bidet. We here in America pride ourselves on how clean we are, and we even look down our nose at some other, let's say, French countries about their level of hygiene. So why is it that the only place you find bidets most of the time is in Europe, but here in the U.S., a supposedly clean, as the last guest told us, germ-phobic place, we don't have anything to kind of take care of the situation down there? By the way, in case you are totally in the dark, that was the part where I was going to say mud butt, but then I decided it would be inappropriate, so I didn't say mud butt. In case you and your mud butt were totally in the dark, the bidet is like another little toilet that goes next to your actual toilet, and it kind of washes you down there. Okay, but whenever I bring this thing up and how great this device is, people actually say that it's gross. I don't understand how it's gross. That's like saying showering is gross. And maybe people don't want to install another big porcelain device in their bathroom. The good news is, though, now you don't have to.
Hi, I'm Mike Sandman. And for the next few minutes, we're going to be looking at the best seat in the house.
Yes, that's the Mike Sandman, the U.S. distributor of the Intimist. It's $500. It sits right on your regular toilet. No need for a whole other separate apparatus. It even has a dryer. You can check out the demo video on our website, by the way. Listen up, Americans. We can do this. One Intimist at a time. Look, we can make the bidet socially acceptable. Look, you think about it. If you spilled something on the carpet, would you just, like, wipe it up with a paper towel, or would you hit that with some water to make sure it was really, really clean? Okay, for the next month, we're working on the bathroom here at BPP World Headquarters, and while I can't guarantee that it will actually happen, I've got the feeling that the sawbuck I slipped the workers at the new Bryant Park bathroom is going to mean a special present for me. That's right, a shiny new bidet in each stall. Yay! And that is the first and probably last ever Private Time with Luke.
Can I come back now?
Yeah, let me light a match. Okay.
Two stolen Picassos recovered yesterday in Paris. We're going to talk to a former FBI agent about tracking down stolen art.
We'll take a look behind the scenes, or I guess behind the scientists, who argue that global warming is a hoax. We're going to ask what a journalist's responsibility is when covering this kind of work.
The best and worst of summer TV with Sarah Bunting from the website Television Without Pity, as well as an update on the Beijing Olympics, which start 1 year from today. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from, I think they're still calling it NPR News even after that last segment. Hi, I'm Luke Burbank.
I know, the Car Talk guys are going to love you now because people apparently always shiver whenever they say it's NPR News. We may overtake them. Yeah. I'm Allison Stewart. Coming up, we'll talk with a former FBI agent who helped hunt down some stolen art. It's just worth millions. But right now, is China ready for the Olympics?
Beijing, we are ready.
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 They know how to make a
promotional ad.
I'm still
a little unclear. Are they ready?
Beijing, they are ready. A year from today, on 8-0-8-0-8, at 8:08 p.m., the Summer Olympics Games will get underway in Beijing, China. By then, China will have spent over $40 billion on a new airport, new subway lines, 11 new sporting venues, and of course, theme songs.
We are ready.
Yeah, they say they're ready, but methinks they doth protest too much. There are some very serious problems surrounding China hosting the Olympics. Problems such as pollution, human rights abuses, those pesky and inquisitive news media journalists. Philip Hirsch covers the Olympics for the Chicago Tribune, and he's on the China good news, bad news beat. Hi, Philip.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. So China has tried to frame the forthcoming Olympics as the People's Olympics, yet we have human rights groups using this countdown date to call attention to various abuses. So first, tell me, what kind of abuses are we talking about? And second, how is China addressing the human rights issue?
Well, there are abuses of people being imprisoned for longer than some people think they should be. There are reporters who have been detained. There are both internet sites blocked. There are all sorts of issues, both strictly human rights issues and freedom of the press issues that China has said that it was going to address between 2001 when they got the games and certainly by 2008 when the games begin. And there are a number of groups involved in trying to free Tibet and groups who are concerned about the way reporters are being detained in China that are using particularly this one-year anniversary as a way to make sure that those issues don't get forgotten. I mean, there was a Chinese baseball team on tour in the United States about 8 days ago, and the Free Tibet groups organized protests around those visits. So clearly, this happened in 2001 before the vote for the games. It is happening now with this massive one-year-out celebration, a one-year-out celebration such as no previous city has ever held. And it will happen again in the immediate run-up to the next August 8th.
But has China done anything to calm fears about these human rights abuses, or are they just saying, hey, look at our new theme songs and our shiny mascots?
Well, obviously it depends on who you're listening to. Yeah. Certainly the groups protesting don't think that China has done enough to calm these fears. And not being in China full time, it's impossible for me to make a judgment on that.
Well, let me ask you about something. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Clearly their feet are going to be held to the fire more and more over the next year. So the one thing that China does not want to do is be embarrassed. But the other thing China is not going to do is relinquish any of the state's power over its people. So you've got two forces here at cross purposes with each other. China's desire to have an Olympics that doesn't cause them to lose face in any way, as opposed to the Chinese government's desire to control the lives of its citizens. So, this is not that much unlike what happened in 1980 in Moscow. Sure. And although there was much, much less protest, and I'm not exactly sure why that is. I think it has to do with China's place in the world as an economic power as we stand now.
One thing that is tangible is the pollution issue in terms of just how dense it is and what an issue it is. You even hear stories, there have been anecdotal stories about the Australians telling their athletes to arrive as late as possible, that perhaps athletes might need to wear masks. Is China doing anything about the quality of the air?
Well, I mean, right now, I guess they're calling the city Beijing, in a combination of rain and the combination of the pollution in the air, which I experienced firsthand a little bit last September. And it's not very pleasant when the sky turns kind of brownish, the sun turns brownish orange under this haze. And, athletes to whom I spoke last year who had competed in a couple of events, including the World Junior Track and Field Championships, said that if you're not there a long time, they don't think it's going to be that much of a problem. However, Jacques Rogge, the president of the International Olympic Committee, said today to CNN he could even foresee the possibility of postponing some endurance event from days when the pollution was extremely bad. China has promised it will remove 1 million cars from its streets. However, it seems as if China has 1 million new cars on the streets every 2 weeks in Beijing. And they've also promised shutdowns of factories. They've moved a couple of large steel mills and a couple of refineries to the suburbs of Beijing in an attempt to alleviate this problem. But the Olympics are going to be held in a very difficult time of year for China. It's hot. It's humid in Beijing. I know they're talking about seeding the clouds and trying to get rain to fall earlier. But, you know, that clearly pollution is an issue which they think that they have solutions for, but which remains a potentially very, very difficult issue.
And also the big question is, I covered the Torino Olympics this past winter, and can I tell you, literally, as I was getting ready to make do a report for NBC News, there was some guy behind me still scrubbing graffiti off. And they kept saying that, you know, Torino, the dream starts here. And we were like, the dream's not clean yet. From what you know, what do you think? Is China going to be ready?
I think China will be
ready. Didn't you hear the song?
That's going to be an issue. I mean, I like the song. The song is pretty humorous. I don't think being ready is going to be an issue. I think factors over which they have no control, i.e. the weather. I mean, they claim they have control over the pollution, but you know, correspondents who've lived in China for a long period of time have described with various degrees of horror how awful that pollution is. Whether you can completely clean it up or not, I'm not sure. And then, you know, whether they consider the human rights protests to be a gnat on the rear side of an elephant or whether they take them seriously is something we're not going to know until next August. But the one thing that's very evident, they do not want any scandal that will jeopardize their games, and that includes doping, which they've had enormous problems with in the past and which they've made great efforts to clean up over the last 5 or 6 years.
Well, Philip Hirsch, who covers the Olympics for the Chicago Tribune, can we check back with you during the year, Philip?
I'd be happy to. I'm actually going back to Beijing, going back to China for the end of the Women's World Cup in September, and to take another look at Beijing as well, to go to the end of the Women's World Cup of soccer, and I'd be happy to talk to you then.
Well, we would love it. Philip Hirsch from the Chicago Tribune. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You know, speaking of pollution, Newsweek magazine has this interesting cover story this week, which we put a link to on our blog. It's actually about global warming, and really it's about the various people who say that global warming isn't actually happening, or that we can't tell if it's caused by humans or not. And the gist of the piece is that there isn't really that much scientific disagreement about if global warming is happening anymore, but that there are these small think tanks, which get a lot of money from energy companies, that have really, really muddied the waters on this, almost kind of disproportionately, I guess. Sharon Begley is the science columnist for Newsweek. She wrote the article. She joins us now. Hi, Sharon.
Hi there.
I guess Newsweek, you guys did a poll of Americans' perceptions of the science of global warming. And what did you guys find in that poll?
Yeah, well, we started this because the editors were sitting around saying, well, you know, surely Americans now recognize that the climate is changing and that it's due in large part to human activities. But, you know, if you get outside New York and, you know, maybe Hollywood and San Francisco, in fact, big chunks of the American public don't think any such thing. So we decided to commission a poll to see, you know, exactly what the numbers were. And there were a number of interesting and even surprising findings. On the very basic question, when we ask people, do you think that the greenhouse effect has made itself felt yet, only 46% said yes. And that's against a backdrop of all of the coverage about heat waves and downpours and floods and Hurricane Katrina and melting glaciers and everything else. But still, less than half of Americans say the greenhouse effect is being felt today. And then we asked the next question that you pointed out. Do scientists disagree? Is there a lot of disagreement among climate scientists on the question of whether the planet is warming and humans are causing it? And there, almost half said yes. There's a huge amount of disagreement, which really reflects the immense success that the denial machine, as it's called, has had over the last 20 years.
And so I guess your point in the article is that there isn't really as much disagreement as people sort of think there is out there. And you say that's largely the result of something you call the denial machine. What's the denial machine?
Well, it's a well-funded, well-coordinated effort by, as you mentioned, think tanks, mostly funded or largely funded by energy interests, oil and coal primarily. A number of independent scientists who, interestingly, we asked, you know, their friends and colleagues, well, what motivates these people? And they, in many cases, just like to be contrarian. If, you know, the herd is going right, they're going to go left. So what you've had is a 20 years worth of a coordinated campaign to do two things in particular. One is convince the public that the science is uncertain, and given that uncertainty, that it would be rash to implement any policies that would be aimed at, let's say, curbing greenhouse gas emissions. And as I say, they've been enormously successful.
I guess so here, and this is at the risk of being drawn into the denial machine. But I mean, there is a point at which, I mean, your point in the article is essentially that there is almost everyone in the scientific world who studies this stuff on one side of this argument, and then these few people on the other side. But I mean, at some point, the entire scientific community was totally in agreement that the world was flat. Is that, I mean, worth bringing up in this conversation?
Absolutely. You know, science has been wrong in the past, but what's different about the climate change research is that the empirical evidence, whether it's ice cores or measuring Arctic sea ice or just the very basics of what have global mean temperatures been doing in the last 100 years, it's all been converging on the single answer that, yes, the world is warming and that human activities are responsible for much of that. So, no, you know, if you ask two scientists a question, you'll get three opinions. And if you ask, is there any uncertainty about the law of gravity, they'll say yes. Science is never absolutely certain, which raises the question, obviously, of what you do before the last dot, the last I is dotted and the last T is crossed. But again, if you look at measures of consensus, and the best one of those is the so-called IPCC process, that's a UN organized group that stands for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And there they get together thousands of scientists from governments, businesses, academia, and green groups to look at the studies that have emerged over the last few years, to weigh them, and to come up with something that they can all agree on. And there have been four such reports since 1990. And, you know, as I said a minute ago, the evidence has been converging. And similarly, the conclusions of this group have been getting stronger and stronger. You know, 15 years ago, there was only a hint that the world was warming and that it was due to human activities. But as the research keeps accumulating, the case has gotten stronger and stronger. Is there unanimity? No. Again, in science, there's never unanimity. But is the preponderance of evidence on one side? Clearly it is.
Well, and we're sort of running short on time here, but I was interested also in the fact that you kind of put a lot of this on journalists and say that, you know, the folks that are writing about and talking about global warming always feel compelled to go interview these kind of lone few kind of global warming deniers. Is it, do you think, partly the fault of journalists who cover this stuff that they get as much credit as they do?
Well, sure. I mean, when you ask why does the public believe what it does, the public is not reading the Journal of Geophysical Research, obviously. They're learning what they do about climate change from the likes of you and me. And again, because journalists are committed to objectivity and balance and fairness, they've applied those principles to a scientific question. And, you know, I would say, as someone who's been writing about science for more years than I will admit to, that, yes, you always hunt down the person who thinks that the consensus is wrong, but then you weigh the evidence. It's not just a matter of opinion, unlike in a political or social issue. If that person has good evidence and good, solid, basic theory, you know, to support his case, then, you know, you can go with it. But unfortunately, that has not been the case with those who have been attacking the emerging science on climate change.
So you don't think that someone's a bad journalist if they are covering this story and they just basically don't give time to the people who say we don't know yet?
I think they're doing the best that they can. And again, most journalists don't have science training, and they don't distinguish an issue like this from, as I said, social and political issues where truly a range of opinion is valid. But in science, there really is a right answer. And even if it hasn't emerged yet, it will. And there is, again, a preponderance of evidence on one side.
All right. Sharon Begley, science columnist for Newsweek magazine. She wrote the cover story this week, Global Warming is a Hoax, asterisk. It's on newsstands now. Thank you, Sharon.
Thank you.
Ask Barry Bonds about the asterisk. He can help you out with
that. Yeah, they could have given it a title that was easier to read on the radio. Thanks, liberal media. Coming up, Homeland Security invents a lightsaber. I'm specially qualified to talk about that story being named Luke. We're going to take a quick look, though, first at the headlines we're following.
Hey, huge thunderstorms brought intense flooding to New York City, causing a dozen subway lines to stop. wreaking havoc with the morning commute. There were 90-minute delays at major airports, and there may have even been a tornado in Brooklyn.
If you believe 1010 wins the local news talk station. Meanwhile, the National Weather Service is issuing excessive heat warnings for several states in the South and Midwest. As scorching temperatures continue to blanket much of the nation, most of the South is going to be in the 90s and hundreds today. At least it's not humid down there. Oh, wait. Major thunderstorms also expected in Nebraska, Missouri, and Illinois.
And speaking of that asterisk, Barry Bonds broke Hank Aaron's home run record in front of 43,000 hometown fans last night. He hit run 756 in the fifth inning against the Washington Nationals. Many baseball fans say the record is tainted by alleged steroid use by Bonds. Baseball commish Bud Selig gave him a call of congrats, and Hank Aaron recorded a video message which was played after his record was broken.
And U.S. airstrikes killed 32 militants suspected of transporting roadside bombs from Iran. The strikes were carried out by helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft in the northeastern Baghdad neighborhood of Sadr City. Local authorities say civilians were among the dead, too. Those are some of the stories we're keeping an eye on this morning.
It hit the papers today that two stolen Picasso paintings worth $66 million, according to USA Today, well, they were recovered in France. And just 4 days ago, five men dashed out of the Museum of Fine Arts in Nice. They made off with four paintings, including a Monet. And last week, the Getty Museum in L.A. agreed to return to Italy 40 different works of art that Italy claimed were stolen. So who are you going to call when your Jackson Pollock has been pinched?
Ghostbusters?
The feds. That's right. The FBI has a special art theft unit. Thomas McShane is a former chief investigator for the FBI's Stolen Art Division and co-author of Stolen Masterpiece Tracker. Mr. McShane, thanks for being with us.
Hello. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing very well. So what is the profile of an art thief? Is it a career criminal, or is he the guy doing the dirty work for some bigger organization?
Well, it runs from A to Z. I mean, we've had them where, you know, it's just a lonely art student to a real sophisticated mafioso type to a bunch of terrorists in Spain who ripped off a $3 million altarpiece to fund their illegal activities.
So how do you unload a piece of art like this? I mean, if I decide to make a lunge at the glass of the Louvre and stick the Mona Lisa in my backpack, I just can't go out and pawn it. How does it work?
It's very difficult. With these high-profile pieces, it's almost impossible. And a lot of times, well, while I was with the FBI for 20 years, we had thefts, major thefts, where the individuals would think they could ransom them back for, you know, the insurance money.
Oh, it was that simple. I'm going to give a phone call and you'll find the painting behind the rock if you put $50 million in a bag?
Exactly. A lot of this happened sub rosa. Many insurance companies did deal with the bad guys. But when it was a painting of such significance as Mona Lisa, or like the largest art theft in the world today, which happened up in Boston, they wouldn't dare try to cut the FBI out or law enforcement.
Ooh, the largest art theft in the world? What was that?
Yes, that happened on St. Patrick's Day in Boston. It was the Gardner Museum, and on the front of my book, they have a picture of one of the most famous Rembrandts ever stolen. It was Christ on the Sea of Galilee, and along with that, these two thieves took a famous Vermeer, the concert.
Oh, you're really going to hell if you take a picture of Jesus.
Yeah, definitely.
There's a $5 million reward out. So if you know of anybody that might have those paintings, I'd certainly like to talk to them.
I was wondering, I guess, do they call you Inspector McShane?
No,
or what was your title?
Special agent retired, but I'm just now an art consultant and an attorney.
You had the perfect name when you were in the FBI if your supervisor was mad at you.
McShane!
You're off the case!
That's it. He always used to say that I was the prima donna. Because we did have front page headlines. They would be working stolen car cases, and they'd be working fugitives, and I'd go run around and pick up a little Picasso, and thanks to Grace Gluck at the New York Times and others, I was front page.
Well, I was kind of wondering, is it, you know, Ocean's 13 is out, and you always see these movies about heists and capers, and it looks so cool, but is it actually like that? Are there any people that are that kind of...
Well, Luke, there was one group in Miami, and it was unbelievable. These were all legitimate real estate people, and they concocted a plan to rip off the Farmington Museum in Hartford, Connecticut. They were a couple went over to London. They were going to call the museum and ransom the paintings back. Luckily, before it occurred, we got they had other stolen paintings that I went down to Miami and recovered. But before the theft went down, we had an undercover agent in there, and he blew the whistle on them, and we arrested every one of them.
Two questions for you before I let you go.
First, yes, Allison.
I'm curious about security. I mean, is it really that lax?
Oh, it's awful. Look at the screen taken in 1980 from
The Edvard Munch
Gallery in Oslo. Taken in 1994. Taken in 2004. I mean, we've had paintings taken a number of times. These people don't get it. The most recent one was a Leonardo da Vinci, Madonna of the Yard one. This guy had put it in the back of his car to take to his other castle in Scotland, and that was stolen. Of course, he has $400 million worth of paintings.
Ah, I see. So when you're working a case where you're trying to crack the case of stolen art within the FBI, what is it? Is it just basic gumshoe work, or is it tips? What can really break a case for you?
The big break is the reward to get the Bureau usually doesn't offer a reward. The big break is like with the largest art theft in the history of America, the Gardner Museum. There's a $5 million reward, and now we haven't heard anything in 17 years. So we're kind of really disappointed with that one. But most of the time, the reward will start, the informants will start coming out of the woodwork, and we get the information. And then like the Rembrandt I recovered in Buffalo, we get another informant to introduce an FBI agent like myself or another undercover agent. And then we negotiate. We have to make sure that they're not trying to con us, so to speak. We have to make sure that the Rembrandt is the Rembrandt, and because these aren't your very trustworthy people to deal with.
No doubt. Undercover agents, reward money. It's cloak and dagger stuff. Tom McShane, former chief investigator.
That sounds like my boss.
I'm sorry. We don't want to give you nightmares sounding like
boss. I'm getting nervous.
He is the co-author of Stolen Masterpiece Tracker. Hey, thanks a lot for the info, Thomas McShane.
Oh, I hope it helps, and thank you so much.
The BPP continues. Coming up, we're going to talk with Sarah Bunting. She's one of the creators of the website Television Without Pity. She's going to talk to us about the joy and beauty of summer television.
I can see her right to my left, right outside the studio. Also, we're going to take a little ramble. A collection of news doesn't quite fit anywhere else, to be honest.
It's the BPP from NPR on your iPod. Well, BRB, OMG.
Hey, thanks for spending part of your day with the Bryant Park Project. From NPR News, I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. Coming up, we're going to talk to Sarah Bunting from the website Television Without Pity. But right now, it's time for a look at some of the news that doesn't quite fit anywhere else into your standard radio program. But luckily, we have a name for that kind of stuff. We call it the Ramble.
Okay, this is from what I like to call the Duh News Network. The first 6 months of this year, the U.S. had the most flight delays ever in that span of time since the government began tracking it in 1995. June also saw an increase in flight delays, lost luggage, bumping from flights, people drinking in the airport, fights breaking up.
Well, first of all,
that was my life last Friday.
Yeah. If they're going to delay you, then I think a little bit of airport drinking is probably to be expected.
Another Amstel Light, please.
Yeah, thank you. And ad Jacksonville entrepreneurs introduced a Michael Vick chew toy for dogs. This is from the super classy news department. Basically, it lets dogs get a little revenge on. Oh, I see. It's of Michael Vick.
Yeah, it's a little Michael Vick doll.
Oh, that is classy. I thought it was. I don't know what I thought it was. That's great. Oh, so they get to chew on Michael Vick. He's, by the way, accused of involvement in illegal dog fighting, as you probably have heard. The toys cost $10.99 plus $2 shipping, and no word on if the NFL or Vic are going to try to stop production of the chew toys.
And your tax dollars at work in a quest to create a weapon that puts bad guys out of commission without killing them or hurting bystanders, the Department of Homeland Security has come out with a device that when they shine it in someone's eyes, it temporarily blinds the person and makes them lightheaded. And apparently also can make them want to puke. I'll just say it. Make them want to throw up. DHS calls it the LED incapacitator. A lot of people are just referring to it as the lightsaber, Luke.
It sounds like exactly what happens to me at the bar at 2 a.m. There's a blinding light. I feel kind of nauseous, and then I get arrested. That would be the Ramble. Right now we've got Matt Martinez with headlines we're following from the BPP newsroom.
Thanks, guys. It happened in San Fran last night in the fifth inning with hit number 756. Barry Bonds is now the home run king. Asterisk. Always put the asterisk. It may be more like cough, sneeze, and wheeze rather than gold, silver, and bronze at next year's Olympic Games in Beijing. According to the IOC, air pollution threatens games set to begin 1 year from today. Teachers in space. That's the best.
Muppets? Yes.
Yeah.
1984 called it. Teachers, once it's pop culture reference.
Teachers
back.
In space. Astronauts, Columbo. Too, as the shuttle Endeavour is slated to launch at 6:36 Eastern Time. And big quake on Indonesia's West Java Island. It's been measured at a 7.5 magnitude. Those are some of the stories on our radar. You can find more on our website all the time, npr.org. I'm Matt Martinez.
Thank you, Matt Martinez.
You're Thanks, Maddie. You got to update that Muppets.
I've been practicing. I practiced that for like 25 minutes.
I liked it.
25
everyone
minutes.
Everyone on this show can say the word asterisk except me.
Yeah.
Asterisk?
No. Asterisk. Not everyone has the gift.
Turn to the right. Hey, when it comes to summer television, it used to be a wasteland of reruns and lots of hurricane coverage. Not so thanks to drama, real life, and fictional. Like the hit The Closer about a lady cop from Atlanta who relocates to L.A. and meets with resistance about the way she does business.
There was a triple homicide. Did you hear that part? Dead human beings.
Did you not know this is department McShane! Policy?
McShane! I wasn't aware, no.
Now, maybe that's why the LAPD usually promotes from within its own ranks rather than bringing deputy chiefs in from Atlanta.
At West, I can think of nothing I'd enjoy more than to sit here and listen to you read me the rule book for hours, but I have some actual police business to attend to.
Kira Sedgwick, all sassy on The Closer. So why has TV taken a turn for the better between June and September? Let's investigate with Sarah Bunting, who watches a lot of TV for a living, we will add. She is one of the editors of the website TV Without Pity, and she joined us here in the studio in real life. Good to see you, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
So I've been reading all these trade papers talking about how it's cable's big win this summer, cable's ruling this summer. Why would that be?
Why would that be this summer? That I don't actually know. I think generally speaking, cable networks are willing to take more risks mm-hmm. with the programming, and that's especially going to pay off in summertime when there's not a lot competing. Like, you're not going up against heroes. You're not going up against Desperate Housewives. So if you are doing something a little more risky, mm-hmm. That people wouldn't necessarily give a chance if something a little more mainstream is on at the same time, then you can sort of plant the seed during the summer.
As it were. Mm-hmm. Notice on TV, you've got Oscar winner Holly Hunter in a new series called Saving Grace. You've got Oscar nominee Glenn Close. She's got a new show. We just heard Kyra Sedgwick there. This can't be a coincidence that these women of a certain age are fronting series all at the same time.
Right. Well, I think they can actually get decent meaty roles now. I think it used to be 10, 20 years ago that TV was viewed as kind of a come down from the movies, that it wasn't serious, that you did TV if you couldn't hack it in the movies. And when Clooney left ER, for example, mm-hmm. that was still like a, is that going to work? Is he going to make it? Which... it seems like a kind of a doy moment now that it's like...
Well, we can add David Caruso to that list, and it's not so doy a moment.
Right, but that's...
but that's just if you have no talent or sense of irony.
And Caruso,
make the movie Jade.
Caruso isn't Clooney in the looks department.
True.
Let's just leave it there. He's a redhead. That's one difference. But anyway...
Is this also kind of the Sopranos effect? Like, they make this really cinematic, shot on film, really kind of complicated... programming that people actually watch.
Yeah, I think TV has gotten better. I think that with more TV, it hasn't actually gotten worse. Mm-hmm. I think that with more competition and also more room on some of the basic cable stations to do something a little different, and on premium cable to do something a little different, that you're seeing people pushing the boundaries of what TV traditionally is or means. And that works for actors too. And especially, you know, it's been a constant refrain of women of a certain age in Hollywood. There's just nothing, like, they can play a mom or they can play a judge and that's it. Or a judge mom.
Judge mom.
Or a mom judge.
Any dramas we should be paying attention to?
Mom judge.
Yes.
From Fox.
Mom judge. That's actually an FX show. They're allowed to curse on it. That's where the mom part comes in. Dramas that, you know, The Closer, I actually haven't seen a lot of because it is... a procedural, which I think that we've seen that genre before, and also her accent is like ridiculous.
She sounds like Granny from the Beverly Hillbillies, like she wants to cook up a mess of possum grits.
Or should be wearing a flower pot as a hat. Yeah. Like it is a little bit too much, and then always with the digging around in the purse, like I can see this, you know, at home. Like I could do this. Maybe not so good with the interrogation of suspects, but certainly the digging through the bag for the linty candy, I'm on it. Don't need a badge for that. Mom judge is a different story. Yeah. It's not really reflecting. But I sort of like the reality TV that's on in the summer because it's so bad.
Let's make that turn.
Beauty and the Geek 2 or whatever. Like if you didn't get everything you needed in Beauty and the Geek 1.
Yes.
Well, the thing I think sort of interesting about it is you have the networks making all the low budget stuff. I mean, these things like The Closer and Mad Men and everything. That costs money.
Oh, yeah.
Meanwhile, you've got all of these reality shows. Let me play one. People haven't heard this one. It's sort of amazing that nobody thought of this before. It's a karaoke competition.
Oh, sure.
The Singing Bee. Let's listen to a little in case you haven't enjoyed this at home.
Previously on The Singing Bee.
Tonight, we've got a special girl power hour of Singing Bee. So let the games begin.
Don't you wish your girlfriend
was a freak like me?
All right, don't you get it? It was like, on it.
I know what boys like, boys like.
Boys like me.
There you go.
There you go.
You wonder why terrorists hate us. I mean, you watch that
boys
clip.
Boys do like that guy. I ran in the men's room.
Hey, by the way, I just want to say, Allison, for the record, very quickly on the Singing Bee, it's not a karaoke contest. It's not about singing. It's just about knowing the words. Because
right.
The singing is so dreadful. If the point was to be a good singer, like I guess it is in karaoke technically.
Sort of. Yeah, the idea was that you have to fill in the lyric at the end. And right. Every time I go on Google Trends after that show airs, people are into it. They're searching the lyrics from whatever was on the Singing Bee the night before. So obviously it's connecting with people in some ways.
Well, and there's another one, which is Don't Forget the Lyrics, which is one of those Fox reality shows that's like so obviously named. Like, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Mean Guy in the Kitchen. They haven't called Hell's Kitchen that yet, but they should. So there's no confusion.
Do you have anyone you love of these schlocky reality shows? Do you think that you really want to share with people and you want people to sign on to?
Well, my excuse is always that it's for work.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Watching it for research. Uh-huh. Mission Man Band.
What is
okay.
that?
Share My Pain. Four members of former boy bands are like put in a house, and then they're going to reform as a man band. So there's the guy that everyone always forgets from NSYNC, and then there's one of the guys from Color Me Bad, who actuarially speaking should probably be dead now, but is actually mm-hmm. just fat. And then someone from LFO. Which
he still does want to sex you up, for the record, by the way.
And then there's footage of him, like, he works at a tire store now.
Oh, now you're getting
it's an honest living. Tires are fine.
But you're making me sad here.
But he has, like, 10 spare tires of his own, and he's rolling a tire through this dusty parking lot, and you're expecting a harmonica to cut. It's like a Bob Dylan song, like.
Bob Dylan just grabbed his chest somewhere.
Yeah. I know. I'm sorry.
Bob Dylan's
I have to
rolling
apologize
over
to a grieving nation
in
for
the grave that he sleeps in every night.
Killing Bob Dylan, but yeah, Mission Man Band, all and right. then yeah, I guess they get drunk and get in fights, and like, it's the real world.
What's it on? What network?
VH1. It is on VH1.
Of course it is.
Celebrity-ality, yeah. I got to tell you, they have some of the most amazingly developed shows: Celebrity Fit Club, and, all that stuff. Yeah. Gold. Yeah.
We do have to ask one full disclosure. Your website was bought by NBC Universal, yes?
Yes, by Bravo.
By really. Bravo. So does that mean, do you ever get sort of text messages from Jeff Zucker saying, hey, lay off?
No, absolutely not.
Project
absolutely
Runway?
Not. I think they really wanted, they sort of keep the editorial separate with us, and they really wanted us to keep doing what we do, because otherwise, what's the point?
I'm glad you do what you do.
Yeah, me too.
You make me laugh.
They're easy targets.
Sarah Bunting, she's part of the brain trust behind the website, Television Without Pity. Check our website later for that. Name that theme song. You're challenging us to a competition? Is something like that?
Apparently,
yeah.
Yes. I am throwing down the glove.
Are you ready? Mm-hmm.
It's on.
I'm ready.
Much like Donkey Kong.
The last 30 years of my life have been preparing me for this moment.
You're going down.
It's really depressing if you think about it, actually. 30 years of my life have been preparing me for playing a game we came up with 4 minutes ago, but
that you're going to lose.
Yeah.
It's bad.
I guess this would be probably the end of the show. Dan looks at me, the producer, Dan Pashman. We've also got Wynn Rosenfeld in there and MJ Davis. I think still trying to book some last-minute guests. The show's over, MJ, but you're doing great.
And Dan's trying to tell me a website that I should tease. Ours or Sarah's? Oh, I'll tease our website, sure. What's the address, Luke?
It's npr.org/Bryant Park. Thanks, too, to Josh Rogerson for pushing the buttons, and, of course, newscaster Matt Martinez. You've been listening to the Bryant Park Project. We'll see you real soon.
See ya.